accomplish.
Yeah, and you did that so well. It was really, really a great example for people. What was the best single experience besides getting to the finals as a contestant on Top Chef?
I think my favorite moment was the Indigenous Food Challenge. Like, this is a cuisine that, you know, just doesn't get the attention it should, even in Wisconsin. Like, it was really telling when, you know, Sean Sherman asked the group of us, like, how many of us have been to an Indigenous restaurant, and none of us raised our hands. That to me was like, I need to remedy that right away.
I think I did good.
I thought my dish was good.
Yeah, I thought it was good too.
Thanks.
I find foams to be useless most of 99.9% of the time.
Yes, it's like my wife calls them spit.
Yeah. However, that was an application in which I was like, this makes sense in a foam.
Right.
Just texturally, it was incredibly fun to eat.
I just wanted to keep building flavor, like using the sunflowers in like four different ways and then just keep building that flavor on there.
One of the Indigenous values that we really look at is being resourceful. And I think the utilization of all those pieces really came through.
Thank you.
Sunflower was one of my favorite ingredients. You didn't disappoint, Dan. I really enjoyed the bite.
Thank you so much.
It was really cool to see, like, one of the judges worked with us at Dan Dan and our, we used to have a French restaurant named Fauntleroy. Before the pandemic, Bryce had worked with us for a little bit. And then I've been active in advocacy work with Elena Terry, who was also on that episode as a judge. And so that to me was like a really special episode. And even though I didn't win that challenge, it was one of those things that, like, I still think that was one of the best dishes I did probably all year.
Oh, wow. That's great. In the earlier seasons, the atmosphere of the show seemed to be a whole lot more adversarial than it became later. And the focus seemed to really become more of a camaraderie and friendship. Is that what you experienced?
100%. You know, I've said this before. It's like one of the greatest things about the show is, you know, the people that you end up meeting. And those are relationships that I'm going to have for the rest of my life. You know, we joke around about us being bonded by trauma, but it's really, really cool. Like, we made lifelong friends.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I really enjoyed that early on in the first few seasons. They seemed to be more at each other's throat. And
yeah,
I understand that kind of creates a drama. But to me, to see people who are in competition with each other, helping each other out and sampling each other's food, giving advice, because they know that they're cooking their food and that's what's going to get them to win or lose. It just seems so much more satisfying to see that kind of a relationship on a television show.
Absolutely. We always talked about this as a group, how like I want to beat you, but I don't want to beat you because you missed something or you didn't do something or you couldn't get something. I want to beat you at your best. To me, it was like, that's exactly how I felt all, you know, the whole season.
How do you think Top Chef did representing the various cuisines of Wisconsin?
I think it's awesome. I mean, I think what they do for, you know, a region and the way they portray it is so great. Like, I think we're going to be reaping the rewards of Top Chef coming to Wisconsin for years to come. Because, I mean, there's definitely a thing. We see it in the restaurants, but not just in our restaurant. I mean, you see it. There was a couple that was in from Texas this weekend at Dan Dan. I was talking to them at the host stand, and they went to Birch. They went to Loopy and Iris. So it wasn't like they were just coming to our restaurant that was on the show. They wanted to go to the restaurants that were, you know, and the chefs that, you know, were on the show as well. And I think that's so cool. And I'm very much like high tide raises all boats. Like, I feel like this, you know, this is going to do so much for the city and for the state. And I, you know, I just can't wait to see how this all unfolds.
Right, right. Did you learn anything about yourself that surprised you from being on the show?
I did. And that's like, you know, the environment and the way the show is structured, like, it definitely challenges you. And you know, you always end up learning stuff about yourself. I think the experience really kind of pushed me out of any sort of comfort zone and made me realize that I can do more than I thought I could. I also am... I'm really good at this whole cooking thing. Like, I am. And it really, like, it showed how mentally strong I was. And yeah. I don't say this with any sort of hyperbole or feeling like I'm, you know, being a narcissist, but like it really kind of showed me that, you know, I'm really good at this and I love what I do. And this is what I was meant to do.
Yeah. So what are your feelings about how the competition ended up? And I know that there was some X controversy. I think it was on X.
It's a wild place, man.
Yes, yes, it is. And I thought it was somewhat petty of people, but you told people to calm down. Everything went fine. How do you feel about how everything ended up?
I am totally at peace with how everything ended up. You know, I look at the meal that I cooked, and the meal I cooked was, it was pretty flawless. Like, I mean, they nitpick, and this is what they do. And there were little flaws in both me and Danny's dishes. There were flaws in Savannah's dishes. How it ended up, you know, it really came down to, I think, that dessert. And, you know, while my dessert was really good, Danny's dessert was something that no one's ever done before. That's what Top Chef is looking for. That's what you see. You see the greatness in the person who wins Top Chef by doing something that's just like never been done before. And that candied seaweed dessert was just outstanding. I ate it and immediately knew that I was not going to win $250,000.
I liked Dan's dessert a lot. It felt different. I loved the juxtaposition between the two courses. I thought it was really nice. This was close. Danny, when I heard he was doing seaweed on dessert, I was like rolling my eyes going, really? Come on, dude. Like, this is ridiculous. And I just shut up when I ate it. This was really good.
Conceptually, it was unusual. Again, exciting, surprising.
Like, we all should be super proud of where we're at. So
cheers to that.
Cheers. But, you know, I still think that what I did get out of it was worth 10 times that.
Right. And you did represent yourself very well. So when they tap you for the Top Chef All-Stars, what are you going to say?
I would probably do it. I really enjoy competition. Like, it's funny, is I'm not competitive until there's competition. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, and it's not even like ultra competitive. It's just, there's something about competitive cooking that's really fun. It's very different than cooking in a restaurant or, you know, cooking at home. Like, it is definitely like on its own thing, and I enjoyed it, and I'm pretty good at it. So, like, I think I would totally do it again if I had the opportunity.
And I think you would win this time for sure. Dan Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on becoming a finalist on Top Chef and also representing your state so well.
Thank you so much. It was a true pleasure, and I'm just, you know, I'm just happy to be here most of the time. You know, it was a lot of fun.
Dan Jacobs is a Milwaukee chef and a contestant on Top Chef Wisconsin. Steve Gotcher talked with him. Find out more about Dan and Top Chef Wisconsin at WPR.org/beta.
And it was one of the most joyous and experiences I had working on a film with Martin Scorsese, and the biggest learning experience I ever had. You know, I learned how to watch movies.
Coming up, we work after hours with actor Griffin Dunne. He joins us to talk about his mesmerizing memoir, The Friday Afternoon Club. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's that time of year to get cozy, or as the Danes say, higgy, hi-gigi.
It's pronounced hygge.
How do you practice hygge?
Candles.
Cozy fireplace.
Get in my sweatpants.
And have some tea.
Add one more item to your list, a pair of toasty WPR Merino Wool Crew Socks with a Wisconsin-inspired design. Ask for yours now when you donate $15 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Support for WPR comes from Al Johnson Swedish Restaurant and Boutique, home of Swedish pancakes with lingonberries, a Door County tradition since 1949, now celebrating their 75th anniversary. AlJohnsons.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio brings the state together. With reports from our 8 bureaus around the state, WPR is your connection to the pulse of Wisconsin. We are your source for in-depth news from Wisconsin, the U.S., and the world.
This is WPR News.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Griffin Dunne is an actor, producer, and director. And now he's a writer. His debut memoir is called The Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir. Family is a big part of Griffin's life. His father, Dominic Dunne, was a writer and investigative journalist. His aunt was Joan Didion, one of the pioneers in new journalism. His late sister Dominique also was an actor. He even shared a Manhattan apartment with his best friend and soulmate, Carrie Fisher, while she was making a small space opera movie you may be familiar with. Griffin himself is probably best known for his leading role as Paul Hackett in Martin Scorsese's 1985 dark comedy, After Hours. Griffin was nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance and served as producer on the film. Griffin also co-starred in the 1981 horror comedy, An American Werewolf in London. We talked with Griffin about his star-studded childhood and what it was like to be raised in the land of make-believe.
When you're a little kid, you don't have any other land to make reference to. In retrospect, when I hit my early teens, I found it pretty extreme. You know, my parents were of a generation, you know, where their priorities were their problems in their marriage, their own personal problems, and in our case, the social settings and who their friends were, and particularly on my father's side. And, you know, he was the driver of going to parties. They went out every single night. They would give parties, very elaborate parties, that, you know, some of the greatest movie stars of the time and decades earlier would come to. You know, we were sort of, you know, appendages of that. We were brought down to curtsy and bow and say goodnight, and the grown-ups go, ooh, and ah, and they're so cute, and then we'd be sort of sent up. You know, it's pretty strange. It was like we were based on some sort of royal family or something. But, you know, I wrote the book about that because, you know, it was a remarkable time, and so many of the people, particularly the filmmakers like William Wellman and Willie Wyler and Billy Wilder, became filmmakers whose movies I studied. But I was too young to talk to Billy about Some Like It Hot and Sunset Boulevard, and, which I would have loved to have done.
Mm-hmm. And Double Indemnity. That would have been a nice
one. Oh, Indemnity. I mean, I could have gone on and on.
Sure. Why,
and Ace in the Hole. Why, you
absolutely.
Know, that's, I mean, why did that flop? And tell me about your dark mind, Billy.
yeah. When you were 8 years old, you had an up-close and personal encounter with your favorite actor, Sean Connery. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I saw him doing laps in the pool. My parents, this was a lunch party by the pool. And one of the things I'd noticed, I'd seen Dr. No recently, and so his stardom was pretty much on my mind. But I noticed when he was swimming, there was a big bald spot on the back of his head that he didn't have when he was in Dr. No as Bond. So I noticed that, but still, I couldn't have been more impressed and wanting to get his attention. So I jumped in the deep end, and I was not a very good swimmer. I just sunk like a stone. I just went, you know, being up and looking up at the guests, you know, around, completely oblivious that there's a little kid flailing about in the near the bottom of the pool. And then I felt this hand lift me up by the rump and put me onto the side. And it was 007 saying, you know, a wee bit early for the deep end, Sonny. so that made an impression on me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like your Sean Connery impression. It's very good. What was your
relation?
Oh, sure. Thank you. When you were in your early 20s, you shared an apartment with Carrie Fisher, who was filming a little sci-fi space opera at the time. What was your relationship with Carrie like?
We met when she was 15, and I was 16. And it's one of those things where you just hit it off, like, right away. Like, she's the funniest person to this day I've ever known. I must have been with, like, Jerry Lewis met Dean Martin or something. I mean, we broke out into musicals, singing, making up the lyrics and conversation and laughed uproariously. And we, when I moved to New York, she came to New York. She was in the chorus of her mother, Debbie Reynolds, her musical, Irene. And Debbie said, I want you to be my daughter's roommate. I don't want her to live in New York by herself. You have to do it. And she put us up in a place I couldn't afford, and I paid what I was paying in the East Village or whatever. And, you know, I was her best friend, and I was also like her protector. There was not a man she didn't meet who didn't fall immediately in love with her and use me as the go-between to get to her. Like, what did she say? Did she, I didn't understand when she said so-and-so. So I would be like her the wall between her and all the love interests possible, or her suitors.
Mm-hmm. You're probably best known for your starring role in the 1985 black comedy film After Hours, directed by Martin Scorsese. What do you think of the film, and what do you think of your performance?
I mean, I also produced the film, and A.B. Robinson, my partner, found the script and, you know, sent it to me and said, you're going to die when you read it. This is so perfect for you. You know, I had never had a part in a movie where I was in pretty much every single frame. And it was one of the most joyous and experiences I had working on a film with Martin Scorsese, and the biggest learning experience I ever had. You know, I learned how to watch movies from Marty. He educated me while we were shooting in the pre-production. Hey, this is a Rossellini movie. Hey, this is somebody you should know. And would give me these big clunky VHS tapes. And I think it's one of the best performances I've ever given in my life.
I've read this before. I mean, I'm just rereading it. I don't reread books that often, but I don't know, this one's my favorite. I like it better than Capricorn or Plexus or Sexus. You know, he used to kiss himself after he ate a good meal.
But you know, the movie was not received well. It was like middling. It was like not a big deal. It was like, this isn't odd for Martin Scorsese to make a movie like this. And Americans didn't really get it, or certainly the critics didn't. In fact, I know I was good in this, and I always admired a critic named Pauline Kael in The New Yorker. And I always thought, I'll made it when Pauline Kael mentions my name in The New Yorker. Well, she did, and she called me a second-rate Dudley Moore. So I didn't even get that. But what's happened is in the past, I would say 10 years, this movie, the popularity of this movie has grown so large. It's been redistributed in the UK, on the screens. It's in Criterion Collection. It's raised up the, there's a poll for people's favorite Scorsese's movies. It used to be the most unknown, and it had that dreaded word underrated as a compliment. It's now considered, many people consider it one of his best movies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's stood the test of time.
Yeah, and maybe that was the thing, that it was too early, that you
possibly,
it was too
yeah.
ahead of its time with the film?
There really wasn't a genre for anxiety comedies at the time. Mm-hmm. People weren't used to being laughing and feeling terribly uncomfortable and going through a first-person adventure with a man who, in the worst night of his life.
Yeah.
It's now almost an adjective for people's situations.
Yes, you know. Very well said, absolutely. At one point, Scorsese became very angry with you. Why?
Well, the character Paul, what gets him into this mess is his desire to get laid, let's put it that way. And he meets Rosanna Arquette, which leads him down a rabbit hole in this one night where he becomes very close to, you know, almost, you know, having sex. And Marty wanted me to really have a look of kind of horniness or lust in my eyes, of certain desperation, attention.
Can I ask you something? I've wanted to ask you this all night. Who's Franklin?
Franklin? Franklin is my husband.
Really? Is that his loft then?
He owns it, yes.
Do you live with him?
No, he's in Turkey.
And he said, you know, like, I need you to be celibate for the 8 weeks of shooting. Can you do that? And I went, yeah, of course. And we'd finished a scene. I was with Linda Fiorentino on a Friday morning where she's in, you know, very scantily clad in a little bra. And it's very sexually sexual tension. And we had to cut break for the night or the morning and pick it up on Monday. And over the weekend, I broke my vow and I didn't think anyone would notice. But I'm doing the scene completely different. I'm doing it instead of the continuity of the last. I'm now kind of relaxed and cool. I'm like Pepe Le Pew or something. And Marty goes, cut, Griffin, come here. Did you get laid this weekend? And you could tell it was no. I went, yes, well, God, I'm so sorry, Marty. He went, well, you just screwed up the whole scene. The whole. I don't even know if you might even screwed up the movie. You might. Yeah, I don't. I'm just gonna send everybody home. You know, I can't believe you did that. And I went, oh, Marty, please, 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 no. Just give me a chance. Give me a chance. And he sent me out there, and fear and lust. Turns out they look just the same. And we picked the scene right up from where we left.
That's a great Scorsese impression, by the way. I like your take on that. Yeah. Fans of yours probably also know you as Jack Goodman from An American Werewolf in London. You say that your turn in that movie impressed one of America's biggest filmmakers. Can you tell us about that?
You know, my sister and I both had our film debuts in horror films, which is kind of funny because neither one of us were huge horror fans. I've since met serious horror fans. And I can't compete with that. And I went to see Dominic on the set of Poltergeist, which was produced by Steven Spielberg. And when Steven Spielberg told me, you know, oh, I saw Werewolf, I thought you were great. I mean, Steven Spielberg saw me in a movie?
Now, I'm really sorry to be upsetting you, but I have to warn you.
Warn me?
We were attacked by a werewolf.
I'm not listening to this.
On the moors. We were attacked by a lycanthrope, a werewolf. I was murdered, an unnatural death. And now I walk the earth in limbo until the werewolf's curse is lifted.
Shut up.
The wolf's bloodline must be severed. The last remaining werewolf must be destroyed.
It was a great compliment, a great recognition at that time. I'd never had anything like that.
Mm. In 2017, you got to direct a documentary about the incredible life and work of your aunt, Joan Didion. What was that experience like, and what did it mean for you to do that?
Well, I would say, without getting too, you know, heavy or pompous about it, I would say it was a calling. Joan had been approached by many documentarians, and she turned them all down. And we had an experience where she asked me to make a short about her movie Blue Nights, which is after Year of Magical Thinking, and of which I filmed her in various locations. And we had a great time doing it. And I just knew that this film had to be made. And people don't know what she sounds like. And people don't. Everybody had an impression of her as like from her writing and the brief, you know, interviews that they saw, that she was a sort of a dour woman who thought about, you know, deadly, depressing things all the time. And the woman I grew up with was very funny and had a light trill of a laugh that I was dying to have people hear.
Do you have snakes?
Hmm?
Do you have snakes?
I have no snakes. I'm not a big fan of snakes.
Well, how do you know up in the country?
I just take a rake and kill them.
Killing a snake is the same as having a snake.
Oh, yes, that's true. It was my duty because I was the only one she would allow to do this. And the movie did just that. It showed, people got to see Joan of how she really was because of her relationship with me. They saw her as a family person, as a mother, as my aunt, as a widow, and a woman who'd lost her child. And, you know, she really let me in. And the other mission that was accomplished was it broadened. A whole new generation of readers came to her. You know, her books had to be reordered and reordered. And I was enormously proud of being responsible for that or taking part in that.
Mm-hmm. And well, you should be. Yeah, as you say, it was a calling. Has writing your memoir changed the way you reflect on your life and your career?
Yes, it has. In terms of my career, as I went through, I wrote it chronologically. I wrote through the really, you know, the highs, and then I went through, you know, a low period where, you know, I was making poor decisions and having, you know, identity issues. I was still in mourning. My grief was coming out in, you know, in destructive behavior. And I kind of thought I was, you know, at that time I thought I was a failure. And I thought everybody looked at me like a failure. But as I wrote, then I went on to, you know, that period. And then it was like, oh, then I did this movie. I produced Sidney Lumet, Lasse Hallström, acted in this, did that. And I actually looked at it and went, wow, I did a lot and all sorts of different things. The most startling thing about the effect the book had on me was having to read the whole thing my whole life in 4 days for the audiobook. It was like flashcards of my entire life going through it. And it aged me. And I thought, oh, God, now I actually kind of feel like I'm 69. I'll be fine once I get back on the tennis court and more in the gym. I haven't been able to do. But I did feel a little old. Aged. I felt a little wise, too, if I may say so.
Oh, you may say so, definitely. Griffin Dunn, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the Friday Afternoon Club. It is a mesmerizing memoir.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Griffin Dunn is an actor, producer, and director. He's also the author of the memoir, The Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
She basically thinks of herself as the center of the universe, and the way she's writing this story is if she is just telling it to herself as if she is the center of the universe. So she doesn't name herself to herself, because she is herself. She knows who she is.
Coming up, Colleen Bradley joins us to talk about her mind-bending debut novel, The Ministry of Time. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Love.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, with indoor water parks and theme parks, dining, entertainment, and more. Information on holiday happenings at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world. Do you have questions about something you heard on WPR? Contact our audience services department by emailing listener@wpr.org or by calling 1-800-747-7444.
This is WPR News.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for original, beautifully written books about time travel, workplace comedy, spy novels, and romance, I'm going to make things easy for you. You only need one book. The Ministry of Time by Colleen Bradley. Her brilliant debut novel is set in the near future. A government ministry is collecting expatriates to discover if time travel is possible. Cullen has done her homework and delivered a convincing case for the possibility of time travel. So convincing that the BBC is adapting The Ministry of Time into a 6-part series. She joins us now to share the origin story behind her fascinating concept.
During the 2021 lockdown, I started watching a TV series called The Terror, which is about Sir John Franklin's lost expedition to the Arctic. So in 1845, Sir John Franklin took 2 ships, 129 men, to try and discover the Northwest Passage, and they vanished. All 129 men died in the Arctic. Both ships were never found, or at least not found until, I think, 2016 and 2018, we didn't actually find them. And that's what this TV series was based on. It's based on a book by Dan Simmons, who was also very interested in this story. And I became so fascinated with this expedition and with this TV series and its interpretation that I thought, God, I can feel my brain becoming crackly. I'm becoming obsessed. Because, you know, it was locked out. My brain was cream cheese. It was sometimes TV programs are difficult to follow. But I went to the Wikipedia page. I read the summary for the first episode. And I ran across this name, Graham Gore. I hadn't actually noticed Graham Gore in the TV series. He's not a major character at all. He's not actually a major character in history. He's kind of a footnote, actually. But I thought, that's an interesting name. I'm sitting on my sofa. I can't go outside. I'm not doing anything. I may as well just, you know, click on that, find out who he is. I got to his Wikipedia page and I saw the photo. I saw the photo of him and I read his description, his biography, and the people who sailed with him tended to describe him as a very competent, very kind man, very, very good at his job. And I thought, God, I bet that guy would be great to have around during a lockdown. He sounds amazing. And then because I was, you know, this kind of fizzy brain thing was happening, I was becoming interested in this expedition. I was becoming interested in this very minor character from history, but I couldn't go outside. I couldn't go to any archives. I couldn't do very much research. I ended up finding online a community of amateur polar exploration enthusiasts who were very kind enough to share some of their research and their knowledge. And I started writing the first version of the Ministry of Time for them as a kind of joke, actually. Like, what would it be like if your favorite polar explorer lived in your house?
Yeah. I want to get back to the Franklin expedition for a moment because it is fascinating. And you've said that part of that whole expedition is hubris. Can you tell us about that? I was really struck by that comment.
Sometimes I think about this expedition with a kind of, I suppose it's almost fond exasperation, which is a ridiculous thing to feel about an imperial project. But these men went to the Arctic intending to discover a passage that they weren't sure existed. They assumed it existed, and they assumed if once they found it, it would be very useful for the United Kingdom to have this passage through the Arctic. But, I mean, they went without an Inuit interpreter, even. They just assumed they would get there and it would be plain sailing. They wouldn't wear the clothing that the Inuit wore. They wouldn't wear furs. They wouldn't use Inuit-style sleds because if they started using Inuit technology, it would be considered uncivilized. Basically, they wanted to take civilization with them. They wanted to take England with them and just transplant it into the Arctic, which is a ridiculous, preposterous, stupid thing to do. And I think, you know, really contributed to the fact that they could not manage their march across the Arctic to quote unquote civilization when they eventually had to abandon the ships. They went out there just absolutely convinced they were going to be all right. Harry Goodsir, who was the assistant surgeon on Erebus, wrote to his father, "We've got so much in the way of provisions. You know, the ship is sitting quite low in the water. I have to rest my feet on them. So one thing I can say is that we definitely won't starve to death." And we know, in fact, that is what happened. It's just sort of preposterous to me that these men believed so much in the idea of making history, believing they were making history, that history was something that they could grasp, mold, and mold around themselves, that they just went to the Arctic and died there without thinking of, you know, for a start, checking in with the Inuit to make sure it was fine to tramp through their homelands like that.
Yeah, there's hubris there. There's toxic masculinity. There's racism. Yeah, it's all very unfortunate. You mentioned that you originally were writing the Ministry of Time in the second person, correct? But you actually did write it. You changed that to the first person. And I'm curious about why you decided not to give your protagonist a name.
So there is a logic to that, and it is part of the fact that I was building her out. So when I first started writing the book, she wasn't British Cambodian, for a start. So in the book, now she is a British Cambodian, mixed-race, white-passing woman. In the original version, she was sort of nothing. She was a cipher. And I started building her personality out and making her more specific, partly because she's a person who's falling in love, and she's a person who's choosing to be complicit with a wider project. And I think those are two very personal things. So I needed her to be more of a person. But when it came to the names, she basically thinks of herself as the center of the universe. And the way she's writing this story is if she is just telling it to herself, as if she is the center of the universe. So she doesn't name herself to herself because she is herself. She knows who she is. But then there's a hierarchy of naming in the book. So there's people that she studies in great depth who she thinks of almost in the round, you know, like kind of 360 degrees. And these are the expats, the people who have been pulled from history, the people she is assigned to study. So they all have full names: Graham Gore, Margaret Kemble, Arthur Reginald Smythe. The next layer out are people who she doesn't think of in that same fully realised 360 way. They're people who she thinks of as characters in her story. So they only get first names, and they're people like her manager, Adela, her handler, Quentin, her colleague Somalia. Of course, all these people are not characters in her story. They're main characters in their own stories, and they are things that are happening for them out of her sight. But because she thinks of them as characters in her story, she maybe makes decisions about them, or she reacts to them in a way that sends her down different paths. Maybe if she'd been a bit more open to their experiences, it might have been a very different story for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and plus you had lots of other things to think about. For example, the way you incorporate time travel in such an innovative way, how much cognitive bandwidth and, you know, did you have to endure? Did you have to use to figure out the time travel?
It was tricky. One way I think I did simplify it for myself, and I needed the simplification to make the stakes of the story work, is that it is a time travel novel in which no time travel happens on the page. It all takes place in the 21st century because the narrator is experiencing it in the 21st century in linear time. But we went through a lot of drafts, and my editors asked a lot of very penetrating questions about the stakes of time travel, because if you can just move back and forth in time and fix things, what are the narrative stakes actually? What do you need to change? Do you need to change anything about yourself or your way of connecting with the world if you can just keep rewinding and readjusting? So we had to place limits on time travel, but also just keeping the idea of different possibilities, different timelines straight was also quite tricky. And a lot of it involved me pulling back from the idea of time travel as a sci-fi concept and thinking of it more as a kind of form of narrative, really, as a way of handling time in a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. And I think that's exactly what you did. You've said that you're really interested in time travel as a metaphor for forced immigration. I find that fascinating. I wonder if you could unpack that for us.
Definitely. So all of the expats who are pulled from the past are people who were about to die in their own timeline. And the ministry reasoning for this is that if you pull someone who was going to die, it doesn't affect history because they would have been dead anyway. They wouldn't have been doing anything. So it's okay to pull them. So they're all pulled from different disasters. You know, the Franklin Expedition, the Great Plague of London, the First World War, English Civil War, and so on. They arrive in the 21st century reluctantly. They didn't want to leave their homelands. They didn't want to leave their home eras. It's just they didn't have a choice. They were going to die if they'd stayed. And they can't go back. So that's the important thing. Again, an important limit I've placed on time travel. They can never go back to their era. They never leave the 21st century. They have to experience linear time in the 21st century. The narrator of the book, her mother is Cambodian. So she would have left Cambodia and fled Pol Pot's regime in the Khmer Rouge in the same way. You know, she didn't want to leave Cambodia. It was her home. It was where she felt familiar, where she understood the culture, where she understood the traditions, but she had to leave because otherwise she would have died. So she, like the expats, arrives in 21st century Britain, well, 20th century Britain as it would have been, and is told, if you want to be here and if you want to stay here, you have to assimilate. And in both cases, both of these people, these refugees from time and these refugees from other countries, are told, if you want to stay in Britain, you've got to use the right language, you've got to dress the right way, you've got to prove that you can fit in, you've got to prove that you share our values. And that's the only way that we're going to say that you are British and you belong.
Mm. Yeah. Did you know that you were going to use time travel as a metaphor for forced immigration, or did that just kind of come up as you were writing the novel?
It started developing in the first draft, actually, because as I was writing the first draft, which was just the game and trying to think about Graham Gore as a human being, as a person, as someone who has emotional and psychological reactions to the 21st century, I kept on coming back to the research. I kept on bumping into things like his parents, because he has no grave, his parents put his name on their graves. His youngest brother named his first son Graham. And I kept on thinking, oh God, he didn't know any of this. He missed his family. He didn't realize they were all gone. And then, you know, thinking about the realism of that, of some what would it actually mean for this person to be dragged out of time and to have to adjust to the 21st century. Then that parallel became more obvious to me, this idea of forced immigration. And then when I was developing the Bridges character, the narrator's character, and I decided to make her British Cambodian, I thought there is a very clear parallel here. So it came out in the writing of the first draft, and it was developed as I developed the story.
Interesting. You have said that your protagonist is British Cambodian, and you have said that you might be the first British Cambodian person to publish a novel. Assuming this is the case, what does that mean to you?
That's a good question. You know, no one's asked me that. As far as I'm aware, I don't know if it is true, but as far as I'm aware, I think I am the first British Cambodian person to have published a novel in the UK. It feels, I suppose, I'm very happy to have contributed to the amplification of Southeast Asian voices in the UK. I very much hope that my being published means that there will be many, many more. I hope I won't, you know, I may be the first, but I hope the second is very, very close behind me, and I hope the third very close after them. I hope that it doesn't have to feel like an exceptional or remarkable thing. I hope very soon it becomes. It feels like it's a natural thing to say that you're a British Cambodian writer. I realize the diaspora is not very large in the UK in the way it is in the US and in France, but even so, I hope I won't be the first and only for long.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed about that. Do you feel that that puts, though, for the length of time that you are the first British Cambodian person, does that put pressure on you in terms of writing your future novels?
That's a really good question. And I think the pressure is mainly coming from me internally. I think if I feel obliged to be British Cambodian, to be somehow representative of all British Cambodian writing or all British Cambodian concerns, then there's going to be a lot of pressure. But of course, no one ever is perfectly representative of a single ethnicity or marginalized background. So if I think of myself as a writer among writers, I like to imagine myself in conversation with other writers of Southeast Asian heritage and other British writers, actually, and other writers who come from different marginalized backgrounds. So as I think the way I take the pressure off myself is to imagine myself in broader conversation with so many more people rather than thinking of myself as an exception.
Great idea. That's very smart of you to do that. The BBC is adapting The Ministry of Time into a 6-part series, and A24 is executive producing it. Are you looking forward to that?
It's very exciting. Alice Birch is writing the script, and she wrote the adaptation of Normal People by Sally Rooney. And so I feel, first of all, I'm in incredibly expert hands. I think she'll really get it. She'll understand the emotion and the psychology, and she understands yearning, which I love about her. It'll also be very exciting to see how it changes, because, of course, TV is a completely different medium to books, to novels. I think it will be inevitable that there will be expansions or changes, and I'm really excited to see where it might go. I'm also very excited to see who they cast as Graham, inevitably. I'd really like to see that guy.
Well, who, if you had input into it, who would you like to see as playing Graham Gore?
I genuinely have no idea. But one of the reasons I've become less and less sure, actually, as time has gone on, because now that more people are reading the book and have an image of Graham in their heads, I'm getting more and more people saying, oh, you know that picture of him? He did not look like what I imagined. And so I realize now there's a kind of version of Graham Gore that is completely separate to the historical Graham Gore, which I accidentally invented and is being reinvented by other people's imaginations. So at this point, I'm not quite sure who we should choose.
Right, exactly. Colleen Bradley, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The Ministry of Time. It is an incredible debut novel. I can't wait to watch the series and to read your next book. And if I had the ability to turn back time, we would do this interview over again. But we're not going to go there.
Thank you very much. And thank you so much for your fascinating and brilliant questions. I really, really enjoyed this.
Colleen Bradley is the author of The Ministry of Time. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Dan Jacobs, Griffin Dunn, and Colleen Bradley.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and producer is Steve Gotcher.
Steven, please pack your knives and go.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Adam, please pack your knives and go.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, please pack your knives and go.
We've made some changes here at WPR. If you've got questions, take a minute to visit our website. You'll find all the details at WPR.org/new.
Texting when you drive is against the law in Wisconsin, and 1 in 5 crashes involves distracted driving. That text may seem important, but it's never more important than your safety. Put the phone down when you drive. Your loved ones will thank you. WPR wants everyone to get home safely. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.